Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, before we get to the podcast, just want to remind you to rate and review the podcast. That'll make sure that if somebody looks up Exodus or Ruth, that they will be able to pull up our podcast and see what we have to say on different sections of the Bible. Also, if you have any questions or comments or things that you want to share with us, you can email us now. We now have an email address of growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. That's growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you, even just saying, hey, we're listening and really appreciate it or something like that. I don't know. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back. So in honor of Halloween coming up in just, 6 days?
Mm-hmm.
We thought we would start the podcast with something that we kind of teased a couple podcasts ago, and that is a ghost story.
Yeah. Which, something just hit the window.
Really great that timing.
Something just tapped on the window. It's totally a bug outside that's like wanting to get inside to the light.
Yeah.
That was really creepy.
Yeah.
You just said ghost story. It was like tap, tap.
Tap, tap on the window. And it's, you know, dark out.
Yeah.
So, really great.
Yeah. So, you don't have any ghost stories, do you?
No, I don't. Okay. Which I'm kind of thankful for.
Okay. Yeah. So, and I talked about this a few weeks ago, but we didn't want to take up a whole, 30 minutes or whatever. It won't
take it's not going to take 30 minutes to
give this ghost story, but we were already filling it up with other stuff. But anyways, so I'll give mine. So when I was probably, I can't remember how old I was probably 14 or 15 when my dad moved. We used to live like out in Harrison, Tennessee, and he was moving to a new house that's right next to the railroad tracks near Tyner High School. And it's an old house. Dad had some horses, and they kept them at like this little paddock that was right there next to this house. And I think for a little while it was like for rent, but Dad ended up buying the house, and had like a nice shed and stuff that we added to, roof to it and stuff. But it was somewhat, it was older house, definitely older house, that had been there a long time. It's really odd. Like whenever you go there, it's almost like you're in the country in the middle of the city, there's just so much space to it.
Yeah.
Big, beautiful trees out in front of the house, and it just seems like a little, little white farmhouse, like next to these big fields and stuff. It's not nothing extravagant or anything like that, but it's right next to the railroad tracks. And if you go and search around, if you do like with metal detecting and stuff, we found cannonball, like shards or whatever. Or horseshoes and stuff that from Civil War era, that they just, stuff collected in random places and I guess battles around type thing was going on, and you can collect Civil War stuff, around the area. Well, the story that came to me with the house is that the foundation of the house, that the original building that was on it was a interim Civil War hospital, or not really a hospital as much as a holding place for wounded soldiers so that they could get onto the train and then be taken to better care and stuff. So it'd be interim place for Civil War soldiers that are wounded to come and hang out, or not really, they're not hanging out. But, I lost my leg, I'm bleeding out, kind of thing. I need somewhere to be. They would go there while they waited on the train so that they could take them out. So that's the story that's handed down to the for the house. And we moved in there, and I had not We hadn't set up my room or anything yet, I don't think. And I was having an old soul, I suppose. I would stay up late and watch TV Land. And I'd watch like Andy Griffith or something. I got that from my dad and my stepmom. They loved watching that type of stuff, and I enjoyed watching Andy Griffith with them, or I Love Lucy. That type of stuff used to come on whenever I was a kid on TV Land or on Nick at Night, and I was just up late watching that stuff. I was just by myself, just in the living room on the couch, and right next to the living room was my dad's room, and so he goes to sleep. He's always gone to sleep pretty early and easy, and you know, he snores pretty loud. I never enjoyed the time where I had to like sleep in the same bed with my dad, like being with him, but if you don't get to sleep before my dad, you're not going to get to sleep. So he'd gone to bed, and I was laying on the couch and watching something. I Love Lucy, we'll say. And I hear my dad get up, and you know, it's like you know. Kind of the feeling of knowing your dad's footsteps. They're heavy, or you know, like they just have a certain cadence to them, I suppose. And so I heard my dad get up, and he walked down the hallway, and he went down to the kitchen, and I heard him open the refrigerator, rummage around in it, close it, go back to his room. And I was like, Dad. He's getting up and eating in the middle of the night again, and he knows he's not supposed to do that because, you know, dad's got high blood pressure and stuff, and he's not, you know, dad, you're not supposed to do that. And I got up and I go into his room, and I'm going to give him a hard time about eating late in the middle of the night. And I go in there, and that dude is sawing logs, just like snoring, you know, to it's like, okay, well, he obviously wasn't awake. I don't know. Like, it was really weird. You go in there, and he's just snoozing. And I'm like, that's weird. I mean, but he's always been pretty quick at falling asleep. So it was like, okay, whatever. I don't know. And so I go back and keep watching I Love Lucy. Or Laverne and Shirley. That would be another one. Laverne and Shirley. So I go back and keep watching it. And maybe, you know, 15 minutes later, I hear him get up again. And I hear him walk down the hallway. And I'm like... I'm thinking like I just want to give my dad a hard time about this. And so I get up and I hear him open the refrigerator, and I get up and I go down the hallway, and I get to the kitchen, and there's nobody there. There's absolutely nobody there. And I'm just like, what in the world? And I'm like I have no idea what to, because I heard him go down the hallway. And then now he's not there at all. And so I'm kind of freaked out at this point, you know, and I'm like, this is really weird and odd. And I don't know, am I hearing things? What is going on? This is a new house to me.
Yeah.
It's an old house. And I am just very uncomfortable. But I go back and I'd go back to watching something funny, you know.
See, I would have been like, okay, Dad, I'm going to come cuddle with you.
But, you know, it's kind of like lighting the mood. You know, like how we turn on Gilmore Girls after watching a scary movie. We'll watch scary movies and we'll turn on Gilmore Girls so we can, like, lighten the mood a little bit before we go to sleep. And so I go back and do that, but I'm pretty freaked out. And then he walks back down the hallway to his room.
Nope.
I hear him walk down the hallway, and I'm like, what in the world? And I go in there, open the door, he's dead asleep. I got no idea. I have no idea what happened.
There's no resolution to our ghost story.
There isn't. I think my brother's got a ghost story in the house, too. They lived there for a little bit while their daughter was really young, probably more Sadie's age,
two.
Yeah, maybe a little less. I could be wrong on that, but it was probably even younger. It's probably whenever she was like one or one and a half, and they told me the story of they all three of them were downstairs, or four of them were downstairs, and Sydney, their daughter, was asleep upstairs, and that they heard somebody walking around upstairs, and that my brother, I think he lost it. Out of like fear.
Yeah.
And which is pretty, my brother is pretty well built.
Yeah.
He's a stout man. He's not somebody that you ever want to tango with. But he he's also he's a very kind heart. But he was terrified. And I think my sister-in-law ended up going upstairs to check on their daughter. Because he was so scared of what was happening.
I'd be like, okay, moving the crib to our room or whatever, you know.
Yeah, so anyways, the later years of my high school, my dad still lives there. So yeah. They still live in the house. It's just really interesting. Never had anything like, nothing's ever been thrown at me. Or anything in the house, but it's just broken.
Anything broken?
No, it was a pretty freaky little event.
I just try not to think about that stuff when we go over there.
Yeah.
It's
probably, I was probably just, it was probably just way too late and I was just hearing things.
Maybe.
I mean.
Maybe not.
But it's pretty vivid to me of what happened. But I did it. I they gave me the room upstairs there and I slept, I stayed there quite a bit. But never had any other experiences, but it's pretty freaky, train going by, real ominous, it could be pretty spooky. It's a pretty spooky place.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to be over there like at night by myself.
But it's a gorgeous little
especially
place.
Especially
knowing. Yeah.
Mainly because of your stories. Story.
Like when it snowed, man, that place was, it's just beautiful.
It is very pretty.
Yeah. It's the trees out in front of their house, they're just old. It's just really old.
Mm-hmm.
Like exactly what you would picture in a horror film. So, yeah.
Beautiful, but kind of like a horror film. Got it.
Yeah. So there you go. So that's my ghost story.
Alrighty.
I hope you enjoyed.
Yeah.
So we're gonna pick up back in Exodus and jump into chapter 15. Last chapter, chapter 14 was the culmination of everything that we know of for Exodus. When you think of the Exodus story, Exodus 14 is what you think of. And the parting of the sea, the Sea of Reeds or the Red Sea, and God's deliverance of his people through the waters. And he swallows up, Egypt in the middle of the sea. And we talked about last time, it's the same act is both salvation for one group and judgment for the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it all really kind of, I think, boils down to their choices. Of what they choose to do. And I very much think that Israel in the story has a choice. I think that you were right in that you have this intimidating scene in front of them. And it seems like it doesn't make any sense to do this, but we're going to go, we're going to walk through this. We're going to walk through this sea, on dry land. And they have the choice of which way they're going to go, which scary thing are you going to go into?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to wait for Pharaoh and hope for mercy? Or are you going to follow God into these waters? And how the waters symbolize it's both death and that they're entering into the chaos waters. Cause it's all reflecting on creation and the flood and stuff. And we're going to get more of that in this chapter. It's reflecting on that, but it's also, and even more so, I think, a symbol of new creation, a symbol of new life for the Israelites. It's judgment for the Egyptians and the end for them, and then for the Israelites, they're taking on the role of a new creation. They're a new Adam. in a sense, mm-hmm. As they're going to go forward, and they're going to, you know, if we'll see where they're going to go in this chapter, but or at least start that. But I'm interested, like, if you've heard this story before and you don't know where they're going, I just want to, you know, like, make you think about that for a second. Like, you know the Exodus story, you thought. But right now, here we are 14 chapters in, and this is the end of the story as far as most people know it. And so, you know, maybe, you know, like, we should kind of be humbled by that sometimes, I think, of like realizing that maybe we don't know the actual story. It's almost like the same thing with Jonah. Like, we think we know what the story of Jonah is about. Then we go read it, and we're like, holy moly, I didn't realize that was what it was about. I thought it was about a whale, right? And so, and maybe that's what, you know, like, I think every Exodus movie ends right here. There's really not much beyond this. Maybe, maybe Ten Commandments and stuff comes up. But I think most of what we think of as the Exodus ends right here.
Yeah.
So, we're going to pick up in 15, and this is going to sound very familiar. But essentially what's going to happen here is we're going to transition from narrative to poetry. And it's going to be a song. We're going to be reading a song. So you want to read this?
Alrighty.
Are we breaking this up?
I think I'm going through 21.
You're going to read all of it?
Okay. Yep.
All right.
Go ahead. Then you'll have that last part. All right. Then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has hurled into the sea. The best of Pharaoh's officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deep waters have covered them. They sank to the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, was majestic in power. Your right hand, O Lord, shattered the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you threw down those who opposed you. You unleashed your burning anger. It consumed them like stubble. By the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The surging waters stood firm like a wall. The deep waters congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy boasted, I will pursue, I will overtake them. I will divide the spoils, I will gorge myself on them. I will draw my sword and my hand will destroy them. But you blew with your breath, and the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who among the gods is like you, O Lord? Who is like you? Majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders. You stretched out your right hand, and the earth swallowed them. In your unfailing love, you will lead the people you have redeemed. In your strength, you will guide them to your holy dwelling. The nations will hear and tremble. Anguish will grip the people of Philistia. The chiefs of Edom will be terrified. The leaders of Moab will be seized with trembling. The people of Canaan will melt away. Terror and dread will fall upon them. By the power of your arm, they will be as still as a stone until your people pass by, O Lord, until the people you bought pass by. You will bring them in and plant them on the mountain of your inheritance, the place, O Lord, you made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, your hands established. The Lord will reign forever and ever. When Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and horsemen went into the sea, the Lord brought the waters of the sea back over them, but the Israelites walked through the sea on dry ground. Then Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women followed her with tambourines and dancing. Miriam sang to them, "Sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea."
All right, so surely, you know, if you're able to read along with us with this, I mean, there's just so much repetition throughout this. And it's saying a lot of the same things with different words, you know, just rephrasing it and trying to draw you into the image that's happening or has happened and that will happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll start with this, with 15, with this whole song right here. This is most scholars think that this is the oldest or one of the oldest sections in the whole Hebrew Bible, and mainly that's because of the way it's written. If you think about how can you tell that King James, you know, is Old English, right? Is an older version than NIV.
Ye, thee, thy.
That's right. Thine. So you say certain things, like words come up that don't get used anymore. And you know, so they're obviously older words. If I say ye, you know, or thy, you know, that's an older English word that's not regularly used anymore. And so that's a lot of what's happening here in the way that this poem is written, is it's a lot of old English word or old English, old Hebrew words, you know, that it's structured, and written in such a way that it kind of screams of like, hey, this is not the same era being written as the rest of the text. And so it's probably a song that got handed down over and over again of something that, hey, you know, this is the way that we learn our heritage of this thing, this song that keeps getting handed down. If you think about it, the way that most people remember scripture, especially in this time, is through song. Even in Jesus's day, you didn't have a set of scrolls that was sitting in your house, you know, that you could like, oh, I'm going to go read Leviticus today. No, they knew that stuff like by heart because they sang it. They could sing it. And that's how they remembered it. That's how I like. So like the preamble for the United States or for the Constitution. I remembered that by Schoolhouse Rock. That's how I remember that. And I remember it to this day because of Schoolhouse Rock. And so whenever I learned how to sing it, then I knew it. And so that's what people of this time did. They don't have a Bible that they're able to keep in their house that's a, you know, collection of all the books. A, they're all on scrolls that are each individual scrolls, but those are usually kept at the synagogue or wherever the local place is going to be to have it if they have the whole collection at all. And so the way that they remember it is through song. And so this is one of, you know, I think this is a pretty good example of something like that, where it just gets continually handed down. And it's probably very, very old, again, like the oldest section of the Hebrew Bible that's been handed down. So anyways, so this is the song. It's talking about, it's reflecting on what just happened in the narrative in chapter 14. It's going to say it in a different way and fill it out for you. In a way that poetry can only do, the narrative can't quite grasp.
Well, and it's also a song of praise and thankfulness, which is kind of, and we may get into this more, I'm not sure, but which is kind of opposite of where we just were with, why have you, we wanted to stay in Egypt kind of narrative, when they were so scared as the Egyptians were coming towards them, and then now that they have been delivered through the waters, they are singing this really beautiful song of praise. Yeah. And I think generally when I think about poetry and trying to like navigate it and everything, it's like one of my least favorite things to do. I remember in high school, like, read this poem and tell me what it means, and I'd be like, ugh, no. And even with like Micah and stuff, that was kind of challenging.
Yeah.
And but this one I really enjoyed.
Yeah, see, I love the poetry because I feel like it's something that I can sit and meditate over and come to different aspects of it, because poetry is a way to say a thousand things one way.
Yeah.
You know. And it's like, and so that's what happens, and that's why I think I just love the poetry in the Bible, because it gives me a lot more facets to look at, and different ways of looking at God and understanding him. Because, again, it just says a lot more in a very compact group of words.
Yeah.
So as we get into this, so it says that Moses and the Israelites sang this song to Yahweh, right? And it says, let me sing to Yahweh because he is highly exalted. That exalted word, that's the same one as they went out boldly, that he's lifted up. Just like the went out boldly, they went out with lifted hands. So exalted, he's raised up high. The horse and its rider he hurled into the sea. So there's this juxtaposition between Yahweh, who is on high, and then the horse and the rider who are now in the sea, which is, as far as the cosmos is concerned, the way that they view it, That's the highest and the lowest points. That's what this whole thing's going to talk about, the high and the low. That where Yahweh is and that in the sea, which is, you know, Sheol and then the deep.
Mm-hmm.
But the horse and the rider, I think, is very interesting because it he doesn't just, again, we've heard chariots and charioteers, like Pharaoh, chariots, charioteers, all throughout the narrative. Here they choose to say horse and the rider, and then they're going to later say chariots of Pharaoh. So why say horse and rider here? And I think, in my opinion, I think horse and rider is able to be pulled out more and used for more things than just Pharaoh and his charioteers. Instead, it's like any being that is driven for the use of this, you know, oppression, and the one who's driving it, right? The tool to the oppression and the oppressor. So the tool to the oppression, the horse, the oppressor, the rider. And so then that can be used. Yes, it can be used for Pharaoh and his army. But could it also be used for, it could it be used for the chariots and the charioteers? Absolutely. Could it be even broader? Could it be these powers of darkness, these gods that are behind it, that Yahweh is actually kind of making war with in this story, that he's showing that they're not worth, you know, that they're not anywhere close to being as powerful as him.
Mm-hmm.
The gods that are behind Pharaoh and Pharaoh himself. So now Pharaoh becomes the horse and the gods behind him are the rider.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in most of the cases, you would think of Pharaoh being the rider here.
Yeah.
So it's like, it kind of like maybe every rider is a horse in some way, you know, like how it stacks.
Mm-hmm.
We're all being driven by something, I suppose. So do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. I mean, I do definitely think that obviously your mind goes to, you know, the army riding their horses in. Or, you know, as they're going towards the Israelites. But then when you do see it repeated again, like you mentioned, and it becomes more specific,
mm-hmm.
I think that's what really made me go, oh, maybe this is like really like pulling out from just this specific narrative to cover a broader range of things.
I think this is something that you can look back on as an Israelite in Babylon and realize that God isn't just this way towards Pharaoh. He's this way against any horse and rider.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like it's about the horse and the rider. They're the key in this. The poem's going to start and finish with this.
Yeah.
And so I think it's providing hope for those in the future that it's not just about Pharaoh.
Yeah.
God's not only just mad at Pharaoh. Pharaoh is an example of what she's going to, you know, do that for other nations that are oppressive, even Israel itself.
Yeah.
So
moving on, like in verse 2, I think you have this note about how it also, the scripture also mentions my father's God. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's kind of like calling back to all the way back to Abraham and the original promise. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's bringing the forefathers into it. It's mm-hmm. bringing the promise, those that, to which the promise was made. It's bringing them into it as a fulfillment of those promises,
mm-hmm.
To say that God has been faithful, not just to us, but to our fathers as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's bringing the rest of this, it's bringing the Genesis story up into the Exodus story. And saying, you know, he's done what he said that he would do. So it's bringing in history. I guess, or like the continuation of his promise. I think it's fascinating. One thing that occurred to me is reading in the very first line of this poem, after the horse and the rider, it says that he hurled them into the sea. He hurled them into the sea. And why that stuck out to me was because I was like, I know that I have heard another line of something being hurled into the sea. And when I brought that up to you, you had a thought that wasn't the same thought as mine.
Yeah, my thought was Jonah.
Yeah, yeah. And so fill that out.
So Jonah was, you know, God wanted him to go to Nineveh. He tried to run from God. And when he's on this boat with these sailors, you know, there's a storm happening, and the sailors end up, they're like, what is causing this? Is it your God that is causing this storm? And so they hurl him into the sea. And so that's kind of like, I guess, a negative view of it there.
Well, no, I mean, I think it's showing that just power. Like the horse and the rider, Jonah's going down into death.
Yeah, yes.
He's going down into the deep.
But that's what I mean. A negative look at it of you're being cast into what you would think of would be a certain death.
Yeah.
And then do you want me to talk about the...
Yeah, so then continue.
Okay, so like on the flip side of that, you know, because I was trying to remember which part of it was the hurled in. Was it like when he was thrown in by the sailors, or was it when the fish spit him out? Because I was thinking of hurling. But he gets vomited up onto dry land.
Yep.
And so that was kind of another connection that we had with this of just, you know, it's not in this section, it's at the end of, towards the end of this chapter, I think. Let's see, in verse 19. But we've heard it already in chapter 14 about the dry land.
Yep.
And so that was just kind of neat of how, like, his ultimately brought back to salvation on dry land.
Yeah, and I think as a reader of Jonah, you're supposed to remember, like, that whole instance with Jonah is supposed to make you remember how Israel went down into the waters, and then but they went on dry ground. They went on dry land, and like how God has been merciful to his children, that they went into death, that was Egypt, and he brought them out to life, even in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonah's supposed to think about that stuff. It's supposed to key Jonah in, and he just can't pick up on it. Like, he's just absolutely frustrated by the whole situation with Nineveh, that he refuses to see his own salvation and having compassion on the Ninevites, you know, and wanting them to have salvation too. And so I think that's what's happening there. And so the thing that made me think of was Micah, I think it's chapter 15, or it's not chapter 15, there's no 15 chapter, chapter 7, I think it might be verse 15, but essentially in that, no, I'm sorry, Micah chapter 7, verse 19, it says, "And he will again have compassion on us, and he will trample our iniquities, and you will hurl all their sins into the depths of the sea." And so he, it's not the exact same Hebrew, but the idea is the same of throwing something into the depths of the sea. But here it's not the horse and the rider. What's replaced the horse and the rider is sin and iniquities. And it's almost like, the sin is the rider, because Paul would personify sin. It's like the sin that, you know, is in me, and trying to control me. Sin is this rider, and it's using our transgressions against us.
Again, it's kind of reminding me of Horcruxes in Harry Potter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So anyways.
Spoiler alert.
But to Micah, so Micah is saying the real enemy, the thing that Pharaoh represented, was sin. That's what has subjected us to slavery, and that what God is going to do, just like he did in the Exodus story, he's going to throw, instead of Pharaoh, he's going to throw the sins of the people into the depths of the sea, and they'll no longer be remembered. And so it's like the, you know, Micah is looking backwards, seeing that, and seeing the deeper level, which is that, you know, sin is the ultimate, you know, this ultimate enemy.
Well, and then too, as we were talking about this, it got us thinking about just the flood narrative, and, you know, it's kind of like the sin of the world was, you know, hurled into the sea.
Yeah.
You know, destroyed by the waters, and salvation came through, like, the land becoming dry again.
That's right.
And so it was really cool to have kind of all these connections that our minds were going in different places, but they all made sense. Mm-hmm. Like they all truly tied together.
I think when we do that, I think we're doing exactly what these biblical authors are doing. Mm-hmm. They're tying all of these things together with the same language, and they're doing it on purpose so that you can pick it up. It's a breadcrumb trail. So that we can see how all of these things relate and how this one story helps fill out the big story, the macro story. I think that's key language, and we're going to keep seeing.
Huh? And we also go to like baptism.
Yes, you know, absolutely. No, that's exactly what baptism is. I mean, it is
go into the depths of the waters.
When we enter into baptism, that we go down into the waters and we come up as new life, mm-hmm. right? This new creation moment. And Jesus, whenever Jesus was baptized, he's baptized in the Jordan. That is a significant place to be baptized, in that that's where Israel entered into the promised land. They passed from from east to west, moving into the promised land. Mm-hmm. And so whenever Jesus is baptized in the Jordan, it's like they're saying it's a renewed Israel, that Jesus is this renewed Israel that's entering into the promised land. And he then goes about saying the kingdom of God is at hand. It's here. It is here, and it's coming in and being ushered in through me. And so there's baptism is absolutely that. And Jesus's resurrection, a death, burial, resurrection, that's this entering into the chaotic waters and he's rising up on the other side. That's what all of this has been pointing to. Mm-hmm. And then in our baptism, that we enter into that with Jesus. And so it's kind of like this story, when we are baptized, we are entering into this story. This story becomes our own story. That we could say, you know, we were once slaves in Egypt, but even more so, we could say we were once slaves to sin, mm-hmm. but no longer, because, you know, because of what the salvation of Yahweh is through the Messiah.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that is absolutely the connection I think we're supposed to be making with baptism, and what it's doing. So we've made it a whole two verses. That's the thing about poetry. It takes a long time to go through. But I think what I want to stress for folks is to go through here, pay attention to the repetition that happens and how it's supposed to be filling it out. I mean, verse 4, you know, he cast Pharaoh and his army into the sea. The chariots and his adjuncts, or his choice adjuncts, were sunk into the Red Sea or to the Reed Sea. The deep waters covered them. So verse 5, deep waters, that's the same word that whenever in Genesis chapter 1, whenever it says that the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the deep. That deep is the same thing. This idea of this chaos waters, this thing that God separates out the waters to create the dry land. So you're being tied. You know, the biblical authors are giving you this tie, and how they sunk down into the depths like a stone. You know, there's just a lot of imagery here, I think, that is trying to give you an idea of how serious it is of what happened.
Yeah, and in verse 6, when it talks about your right hand, O Lord, and it repeats, your right hand, O Lord, shattered the enemy, majestic in power. And then later in this chapter, it mentions...
It's 12.
You're stretched out your right hand. And to me, that repetition is just, it points me back to the very beginning of Exodus, when God said, I will, you know, stretch out my hand on, mm-hmm. on these people, on the Egyptians. And it's just kind of reminding me of God keeping his promise and that he did it in the way, you know. Like, they notice that. The mm-hmm. Israelites are noticing, yes, he did exactly as he said he would.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and then you have really interesting stuff with the breath of his nostrils. And by the breath of your nostrils, waters were piled up. Waves stood like a heap. Deep waters in the middle of the sea congealed. And then again in verse 10, and you blew the breath, blew with your breath, and the sea covered them. They dropped like lead in the mighty waters. And so this breath, this is the ruach of his nostrils. So it's the same word. Again, we're going back to Genesis chapter 1 and seeing the ruach of God that hovered over the face of the deep. We've already had deep come up, and now his ruach is doing something.
So this whole section to me, I told you this last night when we were looking at this, is that it kind of reminds me of like an uneven arm wrestling match. There's this talk about how the enemy, or like the Egyptians is what we're picturing in this case, are, you know, they're coming to fight, they're drawing their swords, they're ready to go. And then, but you blew with your breath, mm-hmm. and that's all it took. And so I'm thinking of this like arm wrestling match where God is clearly going to win, but he's allowing them to kind of press as hard as they can against, you know, his hand until he just sort of can just so easily smash it down,
yeah.
you know? And that's kind of the image that I got during this section, because to me, verse 10, but you blew with your breath, was just so powerful of just that would be all it would take from God to handle this situation.
Yeah. So looking at this poem right now I see the breath on either side, seven. So I'm looking at verse 8 and verse 10, and that's structured around 9. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake. And so it's their boasting, right? Their boasting is kind of in the center of this. You got breath on the either side. And then 11 and 7 is about the greatness of God. You're in the greatness of your majesty, you overthrew those standing. And then verse 11 is, who is like you among the gods, Yahweh? Who is like you, glorious in holiness? And then 12 and 6 are about the right hand. So this is actually, so this is structured. This goes out. So the center of this section is 9. And it looks to me like the edges are verses 4 and 13. And so the two things that are being compared in 4 and 13 is the chariots of Pharaoh he cast into the sea. And then 13, the thing that's juxtaposed against it, in your loyal love, you led the people whom you redeemed. So there's two different actions of his judgment on one end and his faithfulness on the other. And so with the centerpiece being that their enemy said, I'm going to go and swallow them up, right? And then what he actually does about it. So anyways, there's a really cool structure there, I think, if you, like, it's almost like an A, B, C, D, E, and then D, whatever, C, B. Well, how do you do that backwards?
However you do the alphabet backwards.
Yeah, I would never pass a test if I had to. Had to do that on the side of the road. It's like, do the alphabet backwards.
And
like, dude, you might as well just say I'm drunk because I can't. Anyways, so I think there's actually a really cool structure there looking at it. You got any thoughts on that?
Well, I did want to talk a little bit about the burning anger, and then also with the contrast there with the unfailing love.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm very triggered when I see like God's burning anger.
Yeah.
And it just makes me uncomfortable. Just like a lot of the stuff we've read has kind of made me uncomfortable, and we've kind of had to work through it and talk through it. But to me, I think in this situation, something that Garrett and I were talking about was, you know, sometimes we expect people to be angry with us.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an okay thing. I think if God wasn't angry here, we'd almost be like, why aren't you angry?
Yeah.
You know, if we are feeling, I don't know, politics is a big thing right now, or
I mean,
COVID stuff, but like, I just think in general, well, just injustices in our world right now.
Yeah.
It's a big thing, and part of it is we want other people to show they're angry too, like that they're angry with us. And if they don't, we almost feel like they're just like on the other side of it. Like that they think the injustice in the world is fine if they're not just as angry as we are about it.
Yeah, maybe indifference towards something
yeah.
doesn't I mean, it definitely doesn't show support for a group of people.
Right.
Right. But I think, I mean, we want God to, we do want God to be angry about certain things,
yeah.
right? Like,
yeah.
I think that, you know, and a lot of times those become selfish things that we want God to be angry about.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're really honest with ourselves, there's certain things that, dadgummit, we want God to be angry about it.
Yeah.
And I mean, let's go, you know, you know, sex trafficking.
Oh yeah.
Like, do we not want God to be angry about that kind of thing?
Right.
Like, we do.
Yeah.
Absolutely, we do.
That he will do that. He we can be feel confident that yeah. he's going to do something about it.
Yeah, and I mean, just the same. I mean, even in your everyday relationships. I mean, think about between me and you. If somebody was going or putting our child at harm.
Mm-hmm.
You want me to be angry about that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you want me to intercede.
And, I would be like, why aren't you upset about this?
You want me to intercede and make sure that our child is kept safe.
Yeah.
And no matter what that takes. And so you want me to be angry about that. And that's a good thing to be angry about.
Yeah.
I think our problem with anger, I think, comes from unhealthy aspects of anger.
Yeah.
That makes us uncomfortable, like a, you know, abusive husband or you know, or a abusive father. Mm-hmm. Those, unfortunately,
yeah,
you know, men in our in relationships tend to wield the really poor portion of that. And then we shine that on God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we project that onto God and say, "Oh, if he's angry, then that's what he must be like." And that's just That's not the picture that the Bible gives us. It's one of that. It's like a father who's protective over his children.
Yeah.
Who's not going to put up with these people anymore. You know, doing this to his children.
And I think too, with the blast of the nostrils coming right after the anger, it took me back to a few podcasts ago when we had talked about God being long of nose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And his patience, that whatever the word for patience was, or slow to anger.
Yeah. So to be slow to anger, the Hebrew behind that is that he's long of nose.
So I feel like I'm kind of reminded there of, yes, he does have this burning anger and he is taking care of it now. That he was, just that word nostrils kind of triggered for me something that, like, but he was super patient with them.
Yeah.
He gave them so many opportunities. And, you know, this is ultimately where we are. And then to kind of remind us that on the flip side, that God's unfailing love in verse 13 will lead you, and your unfailing love, you will lead the people you have redeemed. And just kind of reminding myself that all these things can coexist, mm-hmm. all these attributes can coexist in God, and that it's and that they do.
Yeah.
Not only that they can, but they do.
Yeah, and so I think that makes a good transition into 13. Whenever we read this, in your loyal love, that's the word hesed that we mm-hmm. talked about in Ruth. It's this faithful. It's this unconditioned love that he has for his people, that he's patient with them, that he chooses to stick with them no matter what their response is. And it's weird that he would have hesed at this point, because there's not really been something that they've necessarily done. I guess humanity in general has needed hesed at this point, because, you know, they've been hot trash for the most part, as far as the story is concerned in real life, I suppose. But his hesed is what's going to, you know, and actually this is, I think this is in past tense, and NIV makes an interpretive move, to say you will, mm-hmm. because it hasn't happened yet in the story, that he hasn't led his people quite yet. He's about to lead his people into the wilderness and through the wilderness. But NIV makes an interpretive move to say you will, but in the story, in the song, I think it's actually past tense, and that in your loyal love, you led them. So they're saying it as if it's already happened, even though it hasn't happened yet. At least in the story, it hasn't. Hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, because these lands that they're talking about are like part of the promised land.
That's right.
And so they're on their way there. And I think it's just, it's showing a confidence in the promise here of that this is going to happen. And there, I think you could have it either way of like, yes, this is going to happen, or you could kind of say it's already happened because you're with us kind of thing.
Yeah. And so what 13 is looking forward to is in the story of that he's leading them to the abode of your holiness. And that's, I think that's what the narrative arc of Exodus really is. It's not just about deliverance from Egypt. Deliverance from Egypt is a means to an end. And that end is that they can dwell in the presence of Yahweh, that they can come and be with him in his abode. And that will, the story arc is going to go towards the tabernacle and the building of the tabernacle and creating it. They're going to go to Sinai and they're going to be in his midst at Sinai. And then he's going to say, hey, you know, make this tabernacle according to the pattern that you see. And they make the tabernacle and he goes and dwells in it. And, you know, spoiler alert, the way that the Exodus ends is that he dwells in the tabernacle, but Moses doesn't know how to go in. And so then that's what Leviticus deals with. Of like, okay, now how do we go and actually commune with this God that's in the tabernacle? And so this is looking forward to that, to say that, I mean, the whole point is so that God can dwell with his people. That's the way that this started. Genesis chapter 1 and 2 is about God's presence among his people. And they ruin that.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the story, the rest of the whole Bible is about how God is continually trying to dwell among his people. And so that's what this is looking forward to. It is looking to the tabernacle, but I would even say it can be extrapolated even further in that in his loyal love, he's leading the people to a point in time where they're going to be able to worship God in spirit and in truth, as what Jesus would say at the well.
Yeah.
And then ultimately that we would see in Revelation that, you know, God is among his people. There's no need for a temple because God is among his people. I think that's what it's looking forward
Another
to.
Another theme that we've seen so far in Exodus is having people come to know God.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this section also emphasizes that idea of as we go through and I give you the promised land, these other people are going to know that I am God. Mm-hmm. And based on maybe what they've heard of what has happened to the Egyptians, or maybe what's going to happen with them and how they will see God as they pass through these lands. But I just thought that was kind of a really cool of, you know, hearing the people tremble and, you know, being so fearful of God. It just kind of reminded me of how the Egyptians have been so fearful and how they have kind of come to know God through all these actions that he has taken.
Yeah. And that's the way the story arc is ultimately going to go, is that these, and they're not going to, it's almost like they're, again, it's a trust that this is kind of happen. And this probably won't, you know, 14, 15, all these nations, they're not going to fear them until probably David's reign.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's looking even that far ahead, is how far the story's got to go before this kind of gets, I'll say, fulfilled. But ultimately, it's thinking about the nations. The nations, like you said, are going to come to know Yahweh and through his children, Israel, and the things that he's done for them. And I think that's kind of their point, is that they're supposed to be bringing other people to know Yahweh. And it compares them, though. It does compare them, I think, to Egypt, like whenever it mentions that they became silent like the stone. This earlier in the poem, Egypt was compared to the stone that drops to the depth of the sea.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the ending here to the poem itself is very, very pointed. It says that you brought them and planted them on the mountain of your inheritance, a place you made for yourself to inhabit, Yahweh, a sanctuary, Lord, that your hands established. Yahweh will reign as king forever and ever. And that word planted, I think it's only occurred four other times previous in the text so far. And the first one is that God planted a garden. He planted Eden. So he plants Eden, which is his holy dwelling, right? That's the place where God dwells with humanity. But here it's used for Israel. And the second one is going to be that Noah plants a vineyard. And then the third one is going to be Abraham plants a tamarisk tree. That's where he comes and communes with God. And so in some way, Israel is planted on the mountain of his inheritance. Whenever it uses that word, it seems to me to insinuate, as far as the story has gone so far, insinuate that they're going to be the intercessory point between the world and God. They're going to be, and again, this is going to be the theme, that you're going to be a kingdom of priests. What does it mean to be a priest? That they intercede on behalf of the people.
And we've talked about this, I think, before on the podcast, of this idea of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I said it, but it's like, if I ever were to get a tattoo, it'd be a small mountain tattoo on my wrist.
Yeah.
Because every time that, like they go on the mountaintops is where they're able to be with God and in his presence.
Yeah.
You know, we had the burning bush on the mountain, and then ultimately all the way up to Jesus dying on the cross was on a mountain, on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the ultimate way to be able to allow us to be in the presence of God.
Yeah.
Without all these things that we could read about in Leviticus.
Yeah, ultimately the mountain symbolizes the interconnection point between heaven and earth,
mm-hmm.
Between God's space and man's space. And so whenever they ascend the mountain of Yahweh, it's going up and interceding with God there on the mountaintop. And it's just, it's this beautiful idea of what it is. I mean, this picture in Eden, I think, is very much pictured as a mountaintop. Mm-hmm. You've got the tree of life there. But you also have this river that flows out of the place. It flows out and splits into four other rivers, right? And to have a river flow out of a place, it has to be up high. Water flows downhill. It doesn't flow uphill. And
fun fact.
Yeah. In case you didn't know, it doesn't flow uphill. But so Eden is kind of this mountain garden home of God. And so that's the imagery that's going to be used throughout the scriptures to define or give you an idea of what it's like to commune with God. They'll ascend the mountain of Yahweh. Moses is going to do that in this story. He's going to ascend Mount Sinai and intercede with God. But ultimately, the tabernacle is going to become that place. You know, to go into the Holy of Holies is to ascend the mountain of Yahweh. And then thinking about Jesus and the transfiguration, they ascend the mountain, right? And then he transfigures before their eyes. And then they're, and then God speaks and says, "This is my son, right? Listen to him." So all of this stuff is happening, and I think they're all playing on the same imagery of this intercessory point between God and man. So Israel is essentially in this picture, Israel is going to be that. But even still, there's something even looking forward past Israel, because it says, "A sanctuary, Lord, that your hands established." In Israel's story, they're going to build the sanctuary. They're going to build the tabernacle, but it's going to be made by human hands. They're going to build the temple, going to be by human hands. So this is even looking further to a sanctuary that Yahweh is going to dwell in that's established by his own hands. And I think John would very much pick up on that and saying that the word became flesh and it tabernacled among us. So the Greek word is skeno. It's literally the same Greek word that's used for tabernacle in the Septuagint, but it says that Jesus tabernacled among us, that the word tabernacled among us. And even Jesus himself would say that, basically, I'm the true temple. I'm the one that this thing always pointed towards. And he's the temple that is the sanctuary here that's built by Yahweh's hands and not by man. And not only is Jesus that temple, but ultimately the way that the New Testament writers would talk about it is that we are the continual building of that temple that's not made by human hands. And so the temple has transformed from some physical building to what Jesus would say is in himself and also in his disciples as they expand the kingdom, that more and more of the temple is being built. Essentially in the followers of Jesus. So as we finish here in this little section, it's like it transitions back to the story a little bit, but in saying that, it kind of recaps it again, that Pharaoh was, you know, taken down in the sea, his chariots and his charioteers, and Yahweh brought back upon them the waters of the sea, and they traveled on dry ground. This is the third time I think this has been mentioned in the last two chapters, at least, that that like almost this exact same thing is talked about. Again, repetition. Repetition makes us remember something. And so I think it's, this seems to be very important to them, that they're saying, hey, you know, God delivered us and he brought us through the sea onto dry ground. And then Miriam, this is the first time Miriam has been mentioned in the scriptures so far. And I guess I thought maybe that she would be brought up before now. I think his sister, like it's mentioned his sister that saves him.
Yeah, I think that's like a, maybe it's Miriam, maybe yeah, it's not kind of
thing. But you're never given the name. But now Miriam, the prophetess, and the sister of Aaron, which is weird. Why not say sister of Moses, you know, instead of saying sister of Aaron? I guess Aaron's important because he's going to eventually be the first high priest, even though Moses is really the one acting as that throughout here.
And again, aren't we like, Aaron's still here?
Yeah. Yeah. But anyways, so she takes her tambourine, you know, her little instrument.
Another item on the leave Egypt checklist.
Yeah, it's like, where did we get tambourines? Like, how did we come up with this? Like, but I guess it was a hey, Egypt, you know, Egyptian who's giving me all of your earrings. Hey, do you have a tambourine? Or give me all of your instruments, you know, as well.
Joseph's bones and yeah, then the tambourines.
Yeah, but essentially, yeah, she leads like the first worship service in the scriptures, leading a whole, you know, whole group of women and singing, and it seems to me that it's the same song. It's like this song is going to be repeated over and over again as they travel through the desert, because she ends it the way that the poem begins, the way that the song begins, which is sing to Yahweh, because he's highly exalted, the horse and his rider he hurled into the sea. And so this section ends the way that it begins, and it's almost like this, the idea here I think is that it's going to keep being repeated, right, as they travel through. They're going to remember, obviously, right? They're definitely going to remember.
Surely.
Yahweh's yeah, salvation. And they're not, like, they're never going to worry again because Yahweh saved them, right?
Definitely.
Because they're going to keep singing this song, and they're going to remember it.
This is a beautiful song.
That's right. And it's going to be obvious to them that Yahweh's going to take care of them. They'll never make any mistakes. All right, so we'll pick up verse 22. And Moses caused Israel to set out from the Reed Sea, or the Red Sea, and they went out into the desert of Shur, and they traveled 3 days into the desert, and they did not find water, and they came to Marah, and they were not able to drink water from Marah because it was bitter. So that's fun. They came to Marah, they were not able to drink from Marah because it was Marah. Bitter is that same word. I think we've talked about this before. But therefore, it was named Marah again. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And he cried out to Yahweh, and Yahweh showed him a piece of wood. And he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There he made a rule and regulation for them, and there he tested them. And he said, "If you carefully listen to the voice of Yahweh your God, and you do what is right in his eyes, and give heed to his commands, and you keep all his rules, then I will not bring about you the diseases that I brought about on Egypt, because I am Yahweh your healer." And they came to Elim, and 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees were there. And they encamped there at the water. So what are your first thoughts, takeaways on this?
Are they really worried about water?
So why is it pointed that they're worried about water?
I mean, you know, he just did an amazing thing with water.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, parting the Red Sea. That is a lot of water to be parting.
You just sang a long, drawn-out song about how Yahweh has control over the waters.
And how he hurled armies, essentially, yeah, into the depths of the sea.
Yeah.
And with his breath, covered them up with water.
And did we not leave with water? Did we not leave with some?
Like, how was that not on the checklist?
Tambourines are on the checklist, but water is not on the checklist. Mm. I mean, whenever I go backpacking, I probably take at least, like, I even have a, you know, well, I've got a water filter. Of course, probably don't have. They
you're
don't,
like, let's see, not I've got my around. Guitar, so yeah. I should be good.
Yeah, exactly. It's like me taking a guitar backpacking instead of taking water. What on earth?
It's their own fault.
Anyways, so they travel 3 days into the desert, and then they're crying out to God, who just, you know, who just formed the seas and took power over the mighty waters. And they're grumbling against Moses. They're already grumbling against Moses. What shall we drink? And you know, so I'm curious, what are your thoughts on, I mean, how should have God reacted, or, you know, versus how he does react?
Well, I mean, that's really more of a, if I were God,
yeah, okay,
how would
okay.
I react? Because God reacted the way he
consistently does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because this reminded me a lot of how he handled Moses early on in Exodus, of just like Moses would be like complaining or like, I'm worried because I can't speak well and blah, blah, blah. And he'd be like, yeah, okay, here's this staff. Here's, you know, here's what you do. And it's, I don't want to say he ignored Moses' concerns, because he definitely addressed them and, you know, brought Aaron in and everything. But he didn't,
he did get angry.
Yeah, he
did get angry, but
eventually.
He provided a solution to that. It wasn't like it wasn't as if he got mad and then he was like, you know what, do away
I'm
with you,
done
Moses.
With you.
Yeah.
But that was after, I think yeah. that was after a little bit of Moses just like kept
absolutely,
on.
Yes.
And so this is kind of the first time that this has happened. So I feel like it's very consistent with how he first was handling Moses, of just like, yeah, okay, I'm just going to throw you a piece of wood. Almost kind of like a roll your eyes at the people moment.
Yeah.
Of just like, yeah, so, these children.
So he gave Moses signs. One of those was throw down your staff and it becomes a snake. And here he's giving them a sign, essentially, mm-hmm. That's throw this down into the waters. And mm-hmm. it changes the waters from being bitter to sweet. So that's kind of interesting.
Again, it's kind of funny to me of just like, all we get is the Lord showed him a piece of wood, and then he's like, I guess I'm going to throw this into the water. Like, yeah. It doesn't even say that, you know, God was like, throw this into the water. He's just like, eh. And again, yeah, you know,
yeah.
Moses
so,
is a pretty old guy.
So I take this for what you want. But I found this very intriguing whenever I was looking through how trees appear in the Bible, one of those being the tamarisk tree that I mentioned mm-hmm. earlier. I mean, you obviously have the tree of life, and then the tamarisk tree. Often you meet God at the tree, mm-hmm. Or up on the mountain, or both, or at a tree on a mountain. But here, so the word wood, in Hebrew, there's no difference between wood or a tree. They're the same thing. I mean, that kind of makes sense. There's no difference between dead wood and a live tree. So in the Hebrew, this is, you might as well, you could even say that Yahweh showed him a tree. So Yahweh took him and showed him a tree, and then he threw the tree down into the waters. And then the waters all of a sudden are this life-giving source. Instead of being death, instead of being bitter, these waters change into a life-giving source. And I think that's really cool. I mean, I think this idea of this saving tree,
yeah,
you know, this life-giving tree.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a few trees that are that way, starting with the tree of life, but I think ultimately culminating with the tree on Golgotha. This tree of life that the God of the universe hangs on, you know, that gives life. So I think that's really cool. But yeah, I think ultimately what we see here is an opportunity for, if God was a wrathful God, if that's all he was, you know, then I think that's the way a lot of times we view the Old Testament God, right? Is that he's just angry, he gets, you know, ticked off at the smallest things. And, you know, so he's just ready to draw his sword and kill everybody. If that's the way that he was, why, you know, there's just no sense of that in this story. Instead, you see patience, and you see this loving, caring God that's taking care of his people in the desert, even whenever they're being frustrating. And so I when looking back on the poem, we didn't know where God was going to show his hesed, right? He has to have, he's going to have hesed. At this point in the story, he hasn't had hesed because he hasn't been with his people yet. He's shown what we saw in Exodus, or the way he's described in Exodus 34 of compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, right? We've seen those three. We've even seen that he, you know, that he doesn't let the guilty go unpunished. But we haven't seen where he is abounding in steadfast love because there hasn't been a relationship yet. And now there's a relationship, and we see that he's being patient with his people even whenever they're being frustrating and they're grumbling against him, even though he just saved their lives. So this is where this hesed starts being shown, I think, to the Israelites as they go into the desert. And I think, and ultimately what we're going to see is that God forms his people in the desert. They're going to go out into the desert, and you would think that that's going to be the place where they die because the desert has no life in it. But because they're in the presence of God, they're going to have life, and he's going to form his people. And ultimately, I think we're left with the, I mean, this is the whole thing of, like, you know, God's wisdom doesn't make any sense to us. And somehow he can take people into the desert and they live, you know, as opposed to die. They leave Egypt, which is full of life, and they go into the desert, and they're actually more full of life there than they ever have been. And I think that's what this last little line is about, that he takes them then to Elim, where there's 12 springs of water. So 12 is pretty significant. There's 12 tribes of Israel. Seems like there's plenty of water for everybody. And I'm interested with springs. Okay, so that's like an I. There's other forms of spring where it's like living water because it's moving. It's always, this one's particularly I. So there's these 12 springs of water. It seems like plenty of water for everybody, for all 12 tribes, and 70 trees so that they can have shelter. 70 trees being more than abundance for everybody to take shade under. I think that's what that's getting at. You have any other thoughts on this? So,
I don't think so.
So ultimately, I mean, yeah, what we've got here is that God's deliverance, but also in these moments, they still get frustrated with him, and yet he continues to show his hesed for them, and he's going to lead them into the desert, give them life, even maybe when they don't deserve it. And I think that is just fundamental to God's character and what he does with us. He leads us out into the desert so that we can have life.